another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Lael McKay, former member of Faith Assembly. Lael, it's good to have you and to finally get to share your story on the podcast. Chino has been building up how interesting this is, and he keeps asking me, when are we going to have her on? When are we going to have her on? So today is the day. Thank you for doing it. Maybe if you could begin by telling everybody a little bit about yourself.
Thank you for having me. When I first connected with Chino about 6 months ago, he learned my origin story and was very curious and asked if I would ever be able to share it. And I just thought, absolutely not. But as I've just healed and grown, I just feel ready. And I think your vulnerability has helped so many of us in ways that you don't know. So I appreciate Chino and his access to information that he's kind of given us a framework to heal, and then your vulnerability. So the combination of the two of you has been really, really helpful. So thank you. So I am the fifth of seven children. I grew up in Indiana. We grew up about 45 minutes from Faith Assembly. And growing up, to me, that was church. It was very normal. We went to church on Sundays in the morning and Sundays in the evening and Wednesday nights. And it was a 45-minute drive. And that was just very much a normal situation. My childhood was so idyllic in a thousand ways. And as I started to unpack all of this, that doesn't change. Like the fact that I experienced so much love and good things in my childhood doesn't change. I mean, we were outside all the time. We had neighbors that were so wonderful. We just always had someone to play with, always had something to do. I, you know, had a Kool-Aid mustache for most of my entire childhood. And just it was so good. And so it's been confusing to kind of work through things and realize that two things can be true, that I experienced so much love. My family was so wonderful in so many ways. And also things about the way I was raised created an environment that was really unsafe. And so, we just had the very best start. I mean, we had grandparents that lived at a lake. We spent weekends at the lake. That set of grandparents were only about 15 minutes from Faith Assembly, so it allowed us access to family that I think a lot of people in Faith Assembly didn't get. A lot of people, I think, ended up being cut off from their family, but because they were so close and we would spend Sunday afternoon in between services with family, that allowed us a sense of normalcy that I think a lot of people within Faith Assembly didn't get. But from my childhood with my siblings, and we played pretend all the time, pretend house, pretend church, pretend school. We were just, my mom would send us outside for the whole day. And then at the end of the day, blow a whistle and all the night kids would come scurrying from all over. And that was, you know, then it was time for dinner or time to go to church or whatever it was. And that was just like my memory of that is just so good. My grandparents owned the Faith Assembly building that in all these conversations about the origins of like from the Glory Barn to the new building, the new building would be what my grandfather owned. They owned the land that then the church was built on. So then that created a connection to that space that was a little bit more significant. My grandfather was the janitor sometimes on the weekends, and I have memories of going over there and, you know, roller skating through the building while he was, you know, sweeping the floors and just playing tag with my cousins in that building. So as I've really been able to comprehend the reality of what that space created, so many of my early memories of it were just running around that building. I think as a child, what you know is what you know, and it's your normal. So it felt very normal for a very long time for me.
You know, that's an aspect that I don't think many people realize who are on the outside looking in. As a child, it's bliss. You don't know about all of these things that are going on. You basically described my childhood right down to the Kool-Aid mustache. That's exactly how we were. And I had a really good childhood. I even had a really good teenage years up until I was an adult. It was really, really fun, really exciting, different people, different meetings you'd go to. When your whole world is wrapped around church, you get excited about church and you get excited about these gatherings and dinner on the ground, you know, this kind of thing. I grew up in that lifestyle and I really enjoyed it. I really did. I know people think that I did not because I'm doing this thing that I do, but it's so sinister and difficult to understand that while the good things are happening, there's this evil thing that is underneath.
When I start to think about the things that were really significant in my life, when it came to the ways that we were not protected as children, I think, well, there were many tenets, and you've talked about this with Chino, where it was a lot of control over what women wore. You know, we wore dresses, no pants. You know, I had jean skirts over sweatpants if I was walking to school in the snow. Like, it was always, you were not to cause a man to stumble by what you were wearing. And so from the time I was very young, I knew that that was my responsibility to protect other people from stumbling based on my appearance. And so it was, you know, we didn't celebrate holidays. That was just always true. But again, that's all I knew. So Halloween, that one's easy and obvious. But then it was, I mean, no Valentine's, no Christmas, none of it, which then, you know, when you're a child, to feel other is just really complicated and really hard. And so every holiday party, you know, I'm sitting in the hall next to my friend Ben, who was Jehovah's Witness, and everyone just thought that that's what I was too. And I was fine with that because it was just hard to explain. I didn't understand why I was in the hall for a Christmas party. You know, it just didn't make sense to me either, but these were the rules. And so there was just so much that we missed out on. You know, I have and I know other people have talked about this, but this like absolute black hole when it comes to any kind of pop culture, like the 90s are just, they just don't, I've had to catch up in a lot of ways to that as much as I can. But no television, no movies, anything that could invite or open the door to sin or Satan. And so of all those things, that was just kind of, I think it got to be more and more and more. It got to be more and more legalistic as things progressed. But what I think was so damaging and so problematic within my own experience with Faith Assembly was the concept of faith-based healing. That was the most important thing. It was your illness is a reflection of sin in your life. And so when they could start to tie your eternal salvation to your well-being, that created a really, really complicated environment for a child. So we had no access to medicine. I got my vaccines when I wanted to go on a Teen Mania mission trip as a teenager, which is problematic in its own ways. But having not had vaccines ever, no medication, not as much as Advil, none of that. So just a couple of those stories. And mind you, recently when I started therapy a year and a half ago, and I'm telling my therapist that my trauma started when I was 14 and 15, and her response to that was, "Oh, honey, you were born into trauma." I got angry and defensive because she didn't know me. She doesn't know my family. She doesn't know my story. So of the things I'll say next, just know that those were not a part of my trauma in my mind. Like, I was angry with her for even suggesting that. But a couple things that I remember specifically, I remember being, I couldn't have been 5 or 6, and going to the bathroom and looking in the toilet, and turns out I had pinworms. I didn't know what that was, but that's just what I saw. And I did not know that didn't mean that, like, you know, demons are eating my insides and I'm seeing a reflection of that in the toilet. I didn't tell anyone, never. I never told anyone, but then went to bed so scared to, like, am I going to wake up tomorrow? What does this mean? But I didn't, I knew we were going to pray over that. And even then that didn't make sense to me. So to think that, like, a little child is experiencing something like that and then just not telling anyone, but having to reconcile what that means for them next. Now I understand, obviously, that's pretty traumatic, but that wasn't even on my list of things that might have been traumatic for me. I had toothaches as a child that were just really, really significant. Had a lot to do with the Kool-Aid, I'm sure. But I had terrible, terrible teeth as a child. And early on knew to just not tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody. And so I would be in my bed at night crying and have to make up a story to my mom as to why I'm upset, because I didn't want her to know that my teeth hurt, because we've prayed for them and they're not healed. So now that's, you know, I knew that maybe that day I stole a grape from the grocery store, and maybe this is just what I get and I deserve. But also I'm 8, so that really isn't fair for a child, but that's just what I knew. And so I had toothaches that were just tremendous, and never told anybody. And then the most significant injury for me was that when I was in fourth grade, we were at a pool and just roughhousing with somebody, and I hit the edge of the decorative rocks on the pool with my leg. And when I looked up, I mean, I knew what I saw. I saw bone and tendons, and it was graphic. And they took me inside and wrapped a towel around my head so I didn't ever have to look at it again. And I have the memory of laying on the counter as people walked into the room and the horror on their face. And as they would see me, they would just, you know, erupt in prayers. And my parents weren't there, but they were able to get there quickly. And we ended up getting butterfly band-aids and iodine, and we just bandaged it up and we went home, and I didn't walk on my leg for 6 weeks. And then that was that. And so I went to school that next fall, and I remember telling a teacher that, oh no, I got stitches, but you know, my grandma's a nurse and she stitched it, but they were infected, so we took them out. Like, none of that was true. But that early on, I knew I have to protect my family. My body knew I wasn't safe, but I was safer than being taken away, or, you know, or whatever things that I feared. And so that's when I learned to lie to protect people. And which is so interesting, because in my childhood, lying was the worst thing. You kind of knew what the punishment for things were, and you could decide accordingly if you wanted to act out. And lying was the worst punishment. And I know what that, and so we didn't lie. Like, that, I just didn't lie. But I could come up with a lie every time I needed to when it came to protecting the people that should have been protecting me, really.
You know, it's ironic, because my father continually said this phrase to me, John, there are two things I hate most in this world. One is a thief and one is a liar. This is a phrase I remember over and over. He would say this often, and like, I don't even know why he was saying it, but I've come to understand that the entire movement, because of this positive confession thing, the entire movement is lying. So you're right. You're in a movement that's like this, and half of the elders, that half the ministers and leaders in this thing were thieves. So, you know,
and it's the other half were liars.
The other half were liars. It's so weird when you stop and think about it. But so our group did not have it as bad as you. We were in the positive confession faith healing thing. We were told that you could go get medication. But then there was this double standard. You could go get it, but you're also supposed to confess that you don't need it.
But what does that mean if you need it?
And also, yeah, if you have the ultimate faith, you won't need it at all. You don't need to go to the doctor. So I can remember, I'm embarrassing myself here, and I'll go ahead, but I remember going to the dentist one time, and he said, John, this is quite a few cavities you've gotten. And I drank the Kool-Aid just like you did early in my life.
Literally.
So I'm just filled with cavities. I want to say that there were something like 20 or 30 cavities, because I had not gone in years. And he said, John, you've got so many cavities in your head. And he said, we're going to have to basically put you on a program for like every so many weeks for an entire year to get rid of these. And I looked at him and I said, no, I want it all done now, today. It was the most pain I have ever had. It was intense pain. But all this to say, and where I'm embarrassing myself, this didn't happen when I first left the cult. This actually happened years after, because still indoctrinated in my head is this idea that you really don't need to go to the doctor. You can just have faith. You can overlook your symptoms. I don't believe this anymore, but it's so embedded into my being that it's hard.
Yes.
It's hard for me to take some Tylenol if I need it. It's that hard. So
yes.
I get everything that you're saying. I can't imagine being in a position where you were, however, in the Hobart Freeman Faith Assembly sect, for those who are unaware, medicine, doctors, all of it was almost completely forbidden, if not completely forbidden. And so yes. If you have a broken bone, if you have something as bad and severe as you, the child might actually die. So that's the reason the horror on the faces, because they all know we can't take the child to the doctor and we must faith it to be better. But in the back of their minds, they all know, you know, as much as I try to faith this away, this is a broken bone. It's just not going away.
And I mean, there are times where I'll have a headache for the whole day and I'll just mention it. And it's rare for me. I don't need medicine often, but it doesn't even cross my mind that it's available to me. And there'll be times that I'll just reference a headache and my husband will say, well, did you take Advil? It's like, no, I haven't. I'll go do that. And yesterday I took Advil in the morning and I thought that I knew I needed it. So I just took it. And that felt like a big step because at 40 years old, it's never, ever my first thought. It just doesn't cross my mind.
Ashley, you just described my day yesterday.
yes. And to someone else, like that would just be so silly, but it's so ingrained and so embedded. When I probably, and this might've been 10 years ago, I was an adult. Another pool incident where there was an injury. My head I split my head open at a pool and we went to urgent care. And this is, I'm 30 years old. I've had access to medicine now for 15 years. We went to an urgent care and the urgent care was closed. And I thought, well, this isn't an emergency. That would be so silly to go to an emergency room. And so I went home and not until the urgent care was open the next day did I go and needed 12 staples in my head. And they were so horrified. They were like, why are you here now? And I was like, well, it wasn't an emergency. I didn't want to go to the emergency room. And they're like, yes. And you've kind of closed that window as to when it's best to close a wound like this. But in my, even then, it's not even about, there might be a piece of it that's like, just tough it out because that's what I knew. I had a friend, we were talking about this recently, and she was like, Lael, there's no honor in suffering. And I was like, okay. Like, I don't think that I realized that I just know to suffer. And that's not necessarily a strength, but I'm okay with it. And so I've had to kind of heal my relationship to that, that there's no sense when we have access to care, take it. And that's not a weakness. And like I said, I wouldn't have even thought that that's what I was doing in that incident. I just knew, well, I'm not dying, so probably don't need to go to the hospital, and still should have gotten stitches about 10 hours sooner and didn't.
It is, you know, like I said, I go through this constantly and I have family members that do as well. Even the ones who are out of the cult now, it's just so, you don't think of it. It's secondhand to other people. They just think, oh, I've got a headache. I'll go take Tylenol. That's what it's for. And I have to like go through these mental steps to say, well, yes, I'm bad enough to really need it. That's yes. You have to cross this threshold, right? And usually that threshold is migraine.
right. Yeah. Yeah. And one thing that Chino and I have talked about a lot, and I know that you two have talked about it on the podcast a lot, is the concept of cognitive dissonance, and you referenced it earlier, but it's like, even as a child, like, I know that this is not how this works, but this is the system that we're under. And so we're going to move forward in this way. And it was just so confusing that we're going to pretend that this works, even though we had very, very little proof that that was true. I mean, we celebrated a lot of miraculous healings that weren't healings. Like, it's been really important to me to only tell my own story, but there are siblings that have experienced things that they, you know, that were healed and they weren't, but it's like, that's the story that's been told. And I would hate to embarrass my family to tell them otherwise. So let's just pretend that, yep, you're right, I'm healed. And that wasn't like a choice for them to be deceitful. It was just easier to just go with what was being said.
Yeah. Out of respect for my family, I don't tell many of the stories, but maybe I can make it vague enough nobody knows who I who I'm talking about. But see, the two cults kind of progressed in different ways. In Branhamism, you progress towards, you know, people go to the doctors, they get medicine. Hobart Freeman, it kind of went more destructive, so it got less doctors, less medicine. Well, on the Branham side, what they did instead was, if you really think about the concept, it is almost exactly the same, but the ends to the means is different. They will over-exaggerate their ailments to the extent that it was a life or death situation, whether it was or not. I almost died when I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, this is the worst case I've ever seen. I mean, this, it's that kind of story, so that you have a testimony. It's often not about what God did, not about what the healing is, but it's literally, do I have a testimony that other people are going to think that I'm prestigious in my faith? That's usually what this ends up to.
So I think what became so problematic for me was this ability to experience something like this and then hide it. That's just what I came to know. So when, like, another thing that was so significant in our kind of theology was, again, it was the 90s. It was purity culture. It was the book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye. It was all of that, where purity rings and all of that. You know, I have memories of being just so young and kind of chaperoning my 17-year-old sister and her boyfriend just to make sure that, like, I just tagged along on everything because they couldn't do any, they could never be left alone because we would, you know, we're so sinful. And so that was the culture and kind of the most important thing in a lot of ways.
You know, purity culture is not something that I've actually had any of the podcasts about, but I believe we're one of the hosts that I have is probably going there. There's so many different aspects of purity culture that not everybody understands who are on the outside looking into these cults. It isn't so much about, are you pure? Did you have sex or not? Purity culture in these cults means, did you show a little skin or not? I mean, it goes right down to the level. And so things progress differently, like I said. In where it has progressed today in Branhamism, there are different, one of the sects close to here, the length of the skirt has to cover the ankle. And if you show just a little bit of your ankle, you're going to cause some man to sin. That's usually the thought. It's always, it's never about the man, it's about the woman causing them to sin, right? And I'll never forget, I grew up from coast to coast, so the varying levels of skirt length is different. When I came here and I saw this, I was like, why are men interested in the ankles of the women? This doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, and I think so much of it too is about control, and that's definitely where it led. It was definitely, it's definitely a control thing. But that led to an environment that when I was sexually assaulted or I was wronged, I took that on as my own shame. So when I was a teenager and a really young teenager, I was working for, a company that they would have young teen assistants go out on these projects for the day and come back. And oftentimes there was two of those. And for every, there was two assistants for every kind of project leader. And this environment started being created where that wasn't always the case, where I was always with this one man. And sometimes they were an hour away. And so there was a time that we were driving home and he was just out of high school. So maybe I was 14 and he was 19. And we were driving home. It was a country road, middle of nowhere. And he starts telling me, you know, this will be so embarrassing for you, because he kind of understood my upbringing. He said, this is going to be so embarrassing for you that you're about to go to high school and you don't know these things. So I would hate that for you. So he finds a very isolated tree line and he pulls over to the side of the road. And then when things happened, that was my own shame that I carried with me, that I must have done something to lead him to think I was open to that, or, you know, and it's like, well, I didn't say no, but also I was 14 and he was in control of the situation. And so that happened a couple different times. And it was always with this, like, almost the underlying sense of it was, I'm going to do this for you and you're welcome, which is just such an especially gross way to harm someone. And I have a memory of being dropped off at my home moments after one of these experiences happened. And my dad is standing on the stoop and we pull up to the house and I jump out of the car and my dad yells, thank you so much. Thank you for getting her home. And I just run past my dad and I go inside, and then the day just goes on. And never, ever was it, never was it discussed. Again, that was my own shame to carry. And then I continued to work with this person after this eventually stopped when I was a little bit older. That stopped. And then I worked with them for 5 years. And I had to be like cool with them because I needed this job. It was a good job that was lucrative in a way that the other jobs were not at that age. And I needed that job. And I had so much shame in it that he knew I was going to hold that secret. He knew that I was. And I never told anyone. And I never. And finally, unpacking this recently, I was telling a friend about it. And she said, Lael, there's not a world in which that happens. And I don't run home and tell my mom. And I said, oh, there is not a world in which I would ever have told my mom that. Never. And one thing that's been so helpful in my therapy and in my healing has been Dr. Gabor Mate. I don't know if that name is familiar to you. His books are really incredible. But one thing that I just recently heard from him was the idea that your trauma is significant, but it's almost secondary to holding the secret as a child and not having someone to tell. And so your primary trauma is that an environment was created in which you couldn't tell the adults when something happened to you. And I think that just built from a very, very young age. And so when I look back and my therapist tells me, you were born into trauma, now I can understand how that's true, because I just held all of that shame for myself. So what happened to me physically was significant.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. What you're describing, it's difficult for many of the men, the male members of the group, to understand. But what essentially happens in these groups, the family unit is completely defunct. It cannot operate as a cohesive family unit because religion has actually replaced, or false religion, I should say, has actually replaced the family unit. So things that are normal and common to other families, such as if something horrific like this happens, you go immediately to your parents and you tell them what happened. That kind of thing is overlooked. And it isn't just that is overlooked, right down to the Tylenol. You know, there are children who won't take medicine because even, like I said, in my group, they would allow it. But if you're constantly hearing how evil it is and how you can be a spiritual overcomer if you don't take it, there are children who aren't going to take it, and there are children who aren't going to tell their parents, I have a headache. Well, one thing leads to another. Now the parent asks them to do something, and they have this migraine headache. Now they don't feel like doing it, and then they get shamed because, well, why can't you work for us? Why can't you do anything that we ask you to do? And so the family unit just spirals out of control, and it is not a cohesive family unit. And it all comes down to the fact that the central figure is more important to the family members than the family themselves. And children being raised in this environment, whenever your parents don't think of you as their primary most important thing in the world, it's this other guy. Well, now you're starting to see this replacement. He's replaced me with the cult leader. I'm nothing to this family. That I grew up kind of feeling this way, and I never really could address that until years later, years after leaving. I started to realize it's not that my family didn't love me. They did, but it's the religion itself had destroyed the family in so much that I didn't feel like it was part of a family.
And one thing that I really haven't touched on much, but was so significant to those early years, not even early years, that's always been true for me, is like the fear of hell. That was so significant. Like that was always present in my mind, because we learned a lot about it and there was a lot of emphasis on it. And so if you're scared of hell, and that's, I mean, I have the very most specific memory of one of the first times I was ever alone. And when you're seven, you know, when you're one of seven kids and you never, ever have a moment to yourself, the first time I came home, or I came downstairs and the house was empty, I didn't know that there was a cat underneath the neighbor's shed. All I knew that the house was empty, and I knew that the rapture happened. It wasn't a question. I just knew. And I knew whatever sin I had committed the day before that made me ineligible to be taken. And that was like shocking and devastating. And I'm scrambling and just panicked. And then everyone walks in the house and I just pretend that didn't just happen to me. And so that was so, the fear of hell and being pure and righteous and faithful was all because your eternity depends on it. And that's scary. And when you're a child and all you know is that hell is forever and ever and ever, and it's the worst thing you can imagine times 10, and it's forever, you're going to be cooperative. You're going to align yourself with what you're told, because that's a scary prospect for anyone. But especially for a child. And I've had to really unpack that. And I've had so much urgency really my whole life of having the answers, because if I'm questioning things, and then what if God comes back in that moment when I'm in question? And so finally, I think the greatest reflection of my healing in a lot of ways is the lack of urgency to be curious, to question, to wonder, to be in awe, to be inspired, but to not have to know right in this moment. Because my whole life was, if I don't know right now, then there's always this fear that Jesus comes back and I'm in this space. Because I mean, those were true. I remember the feeling of knowing the rapture happened and I was not taken.
You know, I'm no longer a believer in the rapture theology as it was taught. If you read even the parables by Jesus of the coming kingdom, the order is quite different than the rapture theology. And it took me a while to understand that, why is Jesus saying the opposite of what we're being taught? However, there are many people today that still believe in the rapture. But the problem that I have isn't so much the theology itself, it's the imbalance. They focus so heavily on heaven or hell, rapture or destruction, that to the children, all they think about is, oh my gosh, I don't feel secure, I'm not going to make it. And there is no security, there's no internal security of whether or not you're saved. I remember leaving many of the church groups and seeing the same teenagers Sunday after Sunday just crying their hearts out at the altar, each one of them afraid that they weren't going to make it. Something that they had done that week is going to just rob them of their salvation.
Yeah.
And I was there with them, you know, a lot of times, because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I don't know if I'm saved or not. Am I? How do I tell? Mm-hmm. And you hear the sermons and they tell you how you tell, and it's usually this positive confession thing. Well, inwardly, you know that the positive confession is a lie. So now you also question the eternal security. And mm-hmm. so the eternal security is actually the bubbling up of understanding that you don't know if you're saved, you don't know if you're healed, you don't know all of the things that they tell you that you must have in order to make it to heaven. You don't know if any of it's true.
Yeah. And it also creates an urgency with how you interact with people. Like, if this is what I know to be true, well, I would kind of be a monster not to tell everyone I know about this. And I remember in third grade leading friends to Jesus, and that was very important to me, because if that's what you know, it would be like such a shame that these people don't know too. And what that creates for a child is just this, like, if I look around and everyone I know is going to burn forever, like, that's just a really heavy way to live.
The fear of hell. I can remember countless sermons where they're just constantly preaching right down to the detailed descriptions. This is what it's going to feel like if you're in hell.
The gnashing of teeth.
Yeah. So they paint these wonderful visions of torture in the back of your minds. And that's how you leave feeling. You basically leave the church feeling like you're tortured. And what it does over time, if you continue doing this, it leads to trauma. And it is spiritual abuse, so you're being abused. You've got abuse trauma. But the trauma persists, because during the week, as you're waiting for the next time you're going to be threatened with hell on the next Sunday, you're throughout the week, that's all you can think of. You're not thinking of mm-hmm. things uplifting. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, over time, people become very negative. Their outlook is negative. The people around them notice they're negative. And it changes their value and their self-worth, which leads into an array of other problems, psychological problems, leading up to even some people are practicing self-harm. So if you're caught up in this type of environment, the only way to break free is to start thinking positively. But if you do, the only way you can think positively is to actually leave the group, which is ironic.
You know, my siblings and I, we've never talked about this stuff until more recently, when the podcast became available to us. And it was validation in a way that I wouldn't have imagined that we'd ever have. And it's opened so many doors to just really incredible conversations with my siblings. And one of my siblings recently, when we were just kind of talking about where we are now spiritually, and he said, "Lael, what I would hope for you is that you can just start to understand the portrayal of Jesus as a loving, gentle shepherd." My brother just wanting me to experience a portrayal of Jesus as a gentle and kind, loving Christ, because that's never, I'm sure that was the intention, that we would know the whole Bible. And I know that we knew all the stories, we learned all the stories, but my memory is how scary all these things were. For me, my story has always been, and I've known this to be true even early on, I always knew that my story is about all the people that protected me when I didn't know that that's what I needed and I didn't know what was happening, but other people on the outside that started protecting me. So what was so significant when I was in about sixth grade is that I started babysitting for a family just up the street. And it was a couple of years of just this, you know, just babysitting. And I will never forget sitting in the car. It was the dad was a dentist. And I don't know at that point if he knew my history at all or if he knew my story. But I remember being in the car with the mom. I was in the car with Katie. And she said, I told her how embarrassed I was of my teeth. I had a big gap between my teeth. I didn't tell her, you know, that I'd had toothaches and pain. I just, aesthetically, I was so embarrassed. And I told her, and she said, "Well, maybe Dr. Spencer could just have you into the office and then he'll send you to the orthodontist." And so when I was about 14 or 15, I went into his office. And they took x-rays, and they were, I'm sure, shocked and horrified. They didn't express that. They were so gentle and kind and loving. And it was a year and a half of me walking home from school or walking from school to the dentist's office. And it was like, it felt like every Wednesday for a year where he just performed an incredible amount of dentistry. I think the term for the kind of dentistry he was providing was heroic dentistry, because he was just like saving me in ways that I would have never, ever had access to. And he did that for me for years. And then I was able at that point to then get braces, and that changed my life. Like, I finally had access. But this was all happening kind of right before my family stepped out of this theology in a way that we then started receiving medical care. And I was home over the summer, and I was able to have dinner with him and asked him, you know, what was that decision to treat me? Because is it true that you did not have consent from my parents? And Katie, she said, oh, he was angry for one day. He was very angry. And then it had to transition to like, okay, now what do I do? And he knew in that moment that what he could do. And I actually had lunch also while I was home with the first hygienist that ever saw me, and just was able to tell her, I mean, I'm a hygienist now, and every bit of how I practice is informed by how they treated me. And she said, Lael, when I saw you, she said, Dr. Spencer thought initially that maybe this was just a situation of neglect. It's a big family, and so it's a situation of a lack of access. And she said, but my sister-in-law was in Faith Assembly, so when I saw you, I knew what I was looking at. And the fact that when I first had access to care, that those of the people that were seeing me were people that were able to provide care in such a loving, kind way. So that changed my life. And that whole family is still so incredibly special to me. And the way that Katie protected me, there were times that every Christmas she would buy me clothes so that when I went back to school, it was like always like Tommy Hilfiger and Ralph Lauren. And I would go back to school with an outfit to say, like, this is what I got for Christmas. Just to one more way to not feel other and not feel different is that I didn't have to tell people I didn't celebrate Christmas. I could just make up a story about what I did for the holiday break and then say, and this is my new outfit. And so that is so much of my story, is the way that people protected me. And they were some of the greatest protectors for me, both physically and emotionally, both.
It's the little things like that that not many people think about. The children have it so difficult in so many ways that you can't even put into words. Little things like, did you celebrate Christmas? I was one of the fortunate ones because my family did celebrate Christmas, because they knew that the cult leader, even though he preached against it, he and his family celebrated Christmas. There's this weird irony, right? So my family did, but there were other families in the cult who didn't. And watching them, whenever I would be around them, just watching the children, their faces, I can remember this. I can remember children wanting presents, and their family just, they didn't celebrate. They didn't, if they did, they didn't make a big deal out of it, and they weren't supposed to talk about it. That kind of thing, it really changes the way that a child, it changes their outlook, because they see all of the other kids are doing it. And again, mentally, it just breaks up the family, because the child doesn't know why the parents aren't doing it. There's this question, does the parents love me? I see the other families, their parents love them. And some of the children can think critically enough to think, well, we're poor, maybe that's why. But not all the families were poor. So you're faced with these questions, right? My family wasn't that poor. Again, we did celebrate Christmas, but what it does to the family, it just tears them apart. And to think that you had somebody on the outside that's helping you, if every child had this, I think how much differently my life would have been if I did have one of these people as a hero for me.
Yeah. And as I've unpacked this with some of my siblings, we had, especially the younger kids, as my dad became ill, and we can talk about that next, but as that became true and my family no longer really had the capacity to care for us in the way that we needed, we had profound relationships. When I think about the way that my best friend like was a friend to me, and her, and the way that her parents took me in, and like my high school boyfriend, his family was just so incredibly caring and protective of me. in ways that, looking back, I've been able to have some conversations recently with some of those people and say, like, did you know I was in a cult? And everybody is, yes, honey, you're the last to know. Like, I just feel like that is, yes, they knew. And of course, that's why they cared for me in the way that, and they were just good people and cared for me because of that. But also they knew that I needed protected in a way that I didn't even know that I needed protected. And in some ways, I have a lot of gratitude for the way that, for what I didn't know, because my outlook was pretty positive for what I was actually experiencing. But I'm glad that there are other people that knew more than I knew. And some of them, you know, they would, maybe I should have done more, or maybe I should have intervened. Or, and I was like, I don't think so, because had you, maybe I would have lost access to you. And therefore you were exactly what I needed and exactly that time. And that's enough. So it just absolves anyone of guilt when they hear my story and think I should have done more. Cause I've heard that as I've told my story recently to people that knew me early on. And it's like, no, you did exactly enough. And had you done more, I think I could have lost access.
I agree. If the family were to find out, I know families that would have cut other families off completely from their children if they knew that they were violating the cult doctrines.
Yeah. So the next thing that was so significant for me is that, and this is when I tried to tell my therapist that when I was 14 or 15, this is my trauma. So what was so traumatic for me is that my dad, you know, he hadn't worn glasses since before I was born. And that is something that was important as a church that Dr. Freeman had preached on, that everybody believed for their eyesight. Well, that obviously isn't how that worked. And so he just didn't drive for my whole life. And so my mom, who's caring for 7 children, you know, pregnant or nursing for 15 years straight, is driving him to work in the morning, dropping him off, coming home, homeschooling, providing meals, all the things that she's doing. And then halfway through making dinner, goes and picks him back up. And that was just the burden that became true to her. Is just breaks my heart. But she very much was a godly, submissive wife. And she just did as she knew to be honorable. So when I was about 15, my dad had a mole on the side of his head that wasn't going away. And it was prayed for over and over and over. And knowing now what we know, it was basal cell cancer. It's the kind of cancer that people get removed 6 and 8 at a time on their face. And it's a mole that needs removed and then you're done. Well, that left untreated became incredibly problematic. So by the time I was in high school, it was a very large open wound on the side of his head. And to look, I mean, it just was really, really traumatic. And so he just was in an incredible amount of pain, and nights were when it was worse, and it was hard to control the bleeding, and it was hard to, he had no pain management and he was in excruciating pain. And so many, many of those nights for me were hearing him in this battle of managing his pain. And then somehow mornings would get better and he would go off to work and he would work for the day. And eventually it became that he worked for the school system. And so then I would see him at school and pretend everything was great and make sure that I would, you know, interact with him, especially if he had a bad night, so that everybody thought everything was good. And I just went out of my way to kind of placate that situation. And I have, looking back now, I did have other siblings that kind of stood up to him and said, like, this is not okay. But, and there are other people that stepped in too, and that just never, ever, he just was firm in his belief. So for 5 years, that was my trauma, was him, you know, being aware at that age to know that I knew, like, what cancer smells like, and to know what those nights were and how I would dread those nights and try and avoid being home. That is heartbreaking, because, and I loved my mom so much, but I just couldn't be there and found all the ways to not be home. And so finally, when I left for college is when it got to a point that it was just unmanageable and he was going to lose his job because of the outward appearance of this wound. So when I was in high school, or when I was in college, he did eventually seek treatment. And by then, that first surgery, I mean, it lasted a day. We had no idea what all they would have to remove. That seemed successful initially, and then it was 5 years of reconstruction and everything that came with that. And then 5 years from the time that he had his initial surgery, he passed. And it's because it came back and all of that. And I always say those last 5 years, those were the good years. There was palliative care. There was a plan. There was assistance. But it was the those years with no answers were just absolutely devastating to my family.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to watch a family member suffering like this and knowing at the same time that if they were to just go to the doctor, just go to the hospital, they could get help. You've mentioned therapy a few times in the course of this interview. How did that come to be, and what are your thoughts on therapy? I know that there's a lot of people who escape these religious groups that really, really need to go see a therapist. But like myself, like you probably were the same way. You've described this with the Tylenol. There's this feeling like defeat if you go to see a therapist. You feel inadequate. You feel less. I was told actually by a minister that if you go to therapy, that's where the demons come in you. Because if you go get mental help, we've watched time and time again, people leave these cults. So how did that come to be? What happened that got you into therapy?
I had for a long time known that there was a lot to unpack. I never even said that I was in a cult. That wasn't even a term that I used for so long. And honestly, I felt like I had many times said, I'm going to unpack that when my mom's gone, because I don't want to hurt her. My mom's 73 and I hope she lives to be 100. So I kind of didn't have a plan to unpack this or go down this road at all. And then a year and a half ago, I was forced into it. My husband and I were in the midst of a crisis within our marriage. I had an experience with a massage therapist that I now fully understand was that I was groomed and sexually assaulted by them. And that was a secret and shame that I carried for a long time. And when I finally told my husband that this happened, I told him of infidelity, which was obviously devastating for us. And we were figuring out how to move forward in that reality. I took full responsibility, and he just kept saying, "This story doesn't make sense. This story doesn't make sense." And I would continue with this story. And we ended up having access to a therapist for couples therapy within just a couple days of this. When we got into therapy, through that, the timing was such that we then learned that this person had a pattern, this person had a history. It was almost as if I needed an intervention to say, like, this is what happened to you. Those things can't happen in that space, in that circumstance, that you are not responsible for that. But all I had known was to hold that guilt and to hold that shame. And for me, it's been so much to unpack all of that and let go of that. And early into that, you know, a couple months into that couples therapy, my husband, you know, we came to a place of healing, and he started to say, you know, Lael, I think that you need to continue down this road. I think that there's a lot for you to unpack. And so for a couple more sessions, I was meeting with my therapist with him, even though it kind of turned into just my therapy, because I just still needed his support. And finally, he just said, there are things for you to go down. Yeah, like, this is a road for you to go down. I think you're ready. And so for me, understanding therapy, it was that I had no boundaries. I had absolutely no boundaries. And I didn't know how to say no to anybody about anything. And to me, that's me just being agreeable. That's me being a middle child. That's me being, you know, that was also around the time of Dr. James Dobson and the whole idea of breaking the strong-willed child. And a child that is submissive is easier to raise, but they are not kept safe. When they don't understand the agency they have over themselves, they are not kept safe. And so as this situation, as I started to unpack this situation, it has changed my life. My therapist says sometimes, she said, you can be you give me too much credit. And I said, I don't think I do, because the intention for us was to heal our marriage, or the reality was that our marriage was going to absolve, and how do we pick up those pieces? So not only did she give us this space in which we could heal our marriage, it's absolutely changed my life to learn boundaries, to grow, to say no, to trust my body. That's the most significant thing in all of this to me, is that I thought that system that keeps me safe is broken, because in my mind, I've gotten myself into these situations that then have made me vulnerable because that system was broken. And I'm realizing that system was never broken. I just learned to override it. You're a child, you can't be trusted, the adults are right. And I learned when I was little, if my body hurt, you ignore that. And so when I'm in a situation that's unsafe, and I know that this energy is changing in this room, instead of just getting up and leaving, I freeze. And it was exactly a reflection of experiences growing up. And so that's how I, continued to carry the shame for this person that I'm just no longer going to carry.
I'm glad you were able to get into therapy. I know that there are a lot of people that I've talked to who have escaped these cults, who are starting into therapy, and they say it's just changed their life. There are things that they did not know about themselves that they wish that they did, mm-hmm. and things that they've bottled up, and right down to what you're describing, ways that just change your life in the way that they have structured your mental outlook on how to perceive the world around you, how to interact with other people. Every single aspect of life has been changed and altered by these cults. And a therapist sometimes can rewire things where it starts to make more sense. Whenever they do, often you find that it changes the way that you look at even your past experiences and your family.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did that affect you?
Absolutely. When I look at this experience that I have just been through recently, and I look back at what my mom and dad experienced, what they walked into when they walked into the Glory Barn back in the 70s, that was a space of so much love. You know, these families had one and two and three kids and were going to the doctor. It wasn't that they had 12 kids and everyone was ill and dying. And you know, for Chino to now say that there are 2,000 plus deaths tied to this church, I believe that. But that's not what they walked into. And I think that they were earnest and they're seeking. And, you know, if things started how they ended, they never would have started. And that was true for me. And I can give my family and my parents that same grace to say, this was a very, very slow manipulative burn that then led them to where they are. And I think it's what's allowed my family to experience a lot of healing, is just that grace and empathy to say, you know, how it started and how it ended are very different. And that's how it was allowed to be. So for me, it has always, I've looked at it as a betrayal to my family, a betrayal to my mom to go down this path. And as I understand it, it's a much greater betrayal to myself to not. It's given me the freedom to heal in ways that I'm just so grateful for.
Well, I'm glad you found healing. I'm glad that you're in therapy. And like I said, anybody who has been in one of these cults, you might consider it, because it will change your life. If you could go back in time, back to the very beginning of this, whenever you were a little child and you were drinking the Kool-Aid and you had the Kool-Aid mustache, and give yourself some advice to help you through all of this, what advice would you give yourself?
Hang on to those around you. My family is so, so important to me and so special to me. And we have been each other's support as we've started to make sense of this recently. And it's also just hang on, because it gets better. There's so much on the other side. I mean, there were days that were in high school, I just couldn't imagine that life could ever be so full and vibrant and beautiful. And it's just hang on.
Glad you did. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, John. I appreciate your story and your vulnerability. You are helping people heal. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information or to share your story, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.